Deep Dive Cleantech, dein Business-, Investment- und Technologietauchgang zum grüneren Wirtschaften von DWR Eco mit deinem Moderator David Wortmann. Ab geht's!
Hello and welcome to the Deep Dive Cleantech Podcast. As always, to try to keep us from drowning in the climate crisis, we will dive into the solutions of the green economy. Today we have an English edition with Luka Umbrzycz, the Chief Commercial Officer of Elavna, an up-and-coming innovative global leader of in-wheel electric vehicles. Hello, Luka. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good. Well, let's start right in the beginning. What are you guys doing?
I come from a company called Elafe. We focus on developing the next generation propulsion systems for electric vehicles of all kinds. More or less, we come out of pioneering the in-wheel motor technology. So motors that are completely housed within the wheels of a vehicle and require no transmissions or any kind of other transfer of power other than the electrical power. And we also focus on complete propulsion systems, including the vehicle control software, vehicle dynamics, and this kind of thing.
All right. This might be already very complicating for some of the listeners. Let's start right in the beginning. So what is the main difference between what you do as an electric vehicle company opposed to, let's say, all the others, the Teslas of this world, the BYDs, the BMWs, Volkswagens, etc.? So what is this in-wheel electric vehicle approach?
So typical electric vehicles usually have one, two, or three electric motors in them, and then they combine these with different kinds of transmission stages. These are typically very high-speed motors, so they spin around at about 20,000 times per minute, and then they have to use mechanical reduction gears and these kind of things to slow it down to the speed of a typical car or a van wheel. Obviously, the wheels go between zero and about 2,000 rotations per minute. That's a typical approach, and they have a central motor. Then they reduce their speed down to a speed which is acceptable for transmitting forward to the wheel, and then they use transmission systems to kind of take the rotation from the motor to the wheels. And typically this is done in a way that only one motor powers two wheels at the same time. Whereas we differ is we put inside at least two of the wheels or more, a motor directly inside the wheel. We fit it into the space that's already available. So between the brake and the rim of the wheel.
Great. You are basically putting two engines into two separate wheels. And then through this mechanism, you are running the car.
Yes. So what we do is we take the existing space that's inside the wheel, so between the brake and the rim. We build a motor that fits in there and can provide enough power and torque to power the wheel itself. And we do so without requiring any gears or transmissions. So we also, at the same time, obviously save a lot of space on the vehicle, which was previously needed for the electric motor with all the gears and transmissions, but also increase the bandwidth of control that you can have. So you don't have to transfer any power, but it's actually generated exactly where it's also used and required. And with this, you get immense freedom, both on the design of the vehicle, but also on the control side.
Okay. And you're leaving out a lot of additional parts, like all the transmission gears and other stuff, which then obviously don't have the risk to get broken. So you have less parts to maintain. And so throughout the lifetime of a vehicle, this also helps you to lower the cost of repairs. Did I get that right?
That's also part of the thing. Yeah, part of the benefits. But the other part is also any kind of transmission systems are typically inefficiencies in the system. So when you are creating mechanical energy at one point and then you have to transfer it to a distant location, you're going to have to lose some of that energy to facilitate that transfer. And obviously by generating the energy exactly where it's needed, you kind of eliminate those losses in the system, meaning that you can have, let's say, put it very bluntly, on a vehicle with the same battery, you have more range.
And do you put those two engines in the front wheels or the back wheels, or maybe even both?
That depends on the vehicle. In the automotive industry, there's a lot of vehicle specific requirements, but typically let's say the majority of our deployments are in a four-wheel drive configuration, but at least two wheels in the rear is a typical installation.
And when you just said that you are actually saving the loss of energy, which is usually gone while you're transmitting energy, obviously, what is the difference? What is the gap between your approach and the typical approach? How much more efficient are you actually? Or what is the extended range you can drive?
So in this case, it's more appropriate to talk, let's say, about the consumption of energy of vehicles. So typically the vehicles, electric vehicles, passenger cars that are on the streets today, they tend to use approximately 18 kilowatt hours of energy per 100 kilometers driven. We can drop that down to sometimes even 10 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers driven. So it's more or less an improvement in the range of sometimes in extreme cases, even 40%. However, typically the range increase that we see in different vehicles is usually between 5% and 15%.
Which is already substantially. Do you have any additional costs producing your type of systems, which might, well, eat up the efficiency benefits again?
So this is a very good question. Overall, you have to account that typically if you have one motor, one power electronics, and then a gearbox and the differential and, you know, half shafts transferring the power, that setup is approximately, not by a lot, but just a little bit cheaper compared to in-wheel motors. Typically, the benefits that we get on the vehicle level in terms of packaging and in terms of aerodynamics, because you have the freedom to design the vehicle to be both comfortable for the passenger, very ergonomic, and still have a very low coefficient of drag. All that combined, you get a net positive, which means that by introducing the in-wheel powertrain, the vehicle maker actually reduces the amount of cost that the vehicle requires to be made. So there's actually a net positive benefit.
So this overall net positive benefit is something between 5 and 10%, as you just described, or is this even higher?
Oh, it can be even higher. So this really depends on what is the targeted segment of the vehicle, who are they speaking to? Is this a premium segment or a less premium segment? What is the scale of the production? And so it's very dependent on the brand and on the OEM. However, in almost all cases where in-wheel makes sense, there's also a big benefit. Basically, if not in cost directly, for example, in cases where you can have identical cost to an alternative solution, you get so many more benefits in terms of vehicle motion freedom. So you now control directly each of the wheels in both directions. And there is a lot of advanced safety functions and comfort functions that are possible to be implemented based on this kind of topology of the powertrain.
So what are the cases where this in-wheel solution does not make any sense?
Let's say if it's direct drive, meaning that it's embedded inside the wheel and has no reduction gears, then typically very, very high torque demanding applications come to mind. So that's where reduction gears are actually the most useful, is when you have a very, very huge amount of torque that you need, but it makes more sense to generate through a reduction gear instead of directly with a direct drive. Some typical examples would be off-road vehicles that require climbing more than 100% slopes, that's 45 degrees, or some heavy-duty transport like big trucks that have to haul 40, 50 tons. In those cases, the typical in-wheel solutions are usually not appropriate, especially because they tend to have smaller rims, but demand a lot more torque. So the ratio between the space that's available to put inside the motor and the required performance of the motor that has to be there is a lot different than compared to a passenger car. But we are very, very strong in solutions for the passenger cars and medium duty and light duty commercial vehicles.
So in typical passenger vehicles, maybe even buses, small transportation, so these kinds of normal daily commute drives, cars, also for, I don't know, let's say craftsmen's cars, etc., this is where your solution actually has all these benefits.
Yes, that is correct. In the recent years, we focused a lot on, we call them mission-specific vehicles. This is because in, let's say, focus theory, you have to find the biggest impact you can make.
obviously, this is a new technology. It's existed for 120 years as an abstract notion. However, we've managed to overcome a lot of the challenges that have been present in the past. And with that, we are trying to really focus on the applications where we can, at this time, for this time in the market, also bring the most benefits. And this have recently been vehicles that have a requirement to not consume a lot of energy. For example, this is solar vehicles. And why is this the case? Because solar power has a relatively low efficiency in terms of how much yield you get from the sun and with respect to the surface you need. So you have cars that typically have between, 4 and 5 square meters of surface that is available for you to put some solar cells on. This actually produces not a lot of energy typically, but if you can design the car in a way and with technologies that enable you to that the vehicle actually uses very little energy to move itself around and its passengers, then the solar impact becomes a lot higher. And also the charging time in that case becomes very short in terms of how long you have to charge per kilometer of range. And all these things together, they kind of show the way that the first adopters in passenger cars in terms of what's going on to the market are solar vehicles. And in one case, also because of the controllability and robustness and reliability of the systems, also pickup trucks for fleets.
But this actually leads me to the question, why isn't everybody else doing it? Like the big OEMs, those who are now heavily going into electric vehicles, why aren't they pushing this solution which you are now pushing?
I'm not really at liberty to say much more in depth, but they are thinking about this. Many of them are already have activities in this direction. The reason why it's not been commercially available before is because there's also a natural transition that's happening. So if you imagine in 2016, 17, 18, they were not even sure if they're going to be building electric vehicles. This came a little bit later, this massive decision. Then you have your first generation, which is let's try to build a Frankenstein and fit everything, you know, as much as possible to keep the existing base of a vehicle and fit inside, just change out the internal combustion engine with an electric powertrain. And then you have the first generation of pure electric vehicles, which means that you understand the requirements, that you can actually build a dedicated platform. And I say platform because it's a typical approach with electric vehicles that you have a scalable system architecture and all the components that you can then use to underpin different model types. So, for example, Volkswagen is a great example of this. And at the same time, you also have your factories and your processes and your supply chain. So you cannot change this immediately. And in addition, you know, this technology is not easy to develop. If it was very easy to develop, everyone would have adopted it a long time ago. But we have, through our 20 years of first research and then a lot of engineering and validation, managed to overcome most of those challenges, which makes technology viable for commercial production actually now. And that is why we are seeing the first vehicles coming to market now.
And do you consider yourself more as a supplier to this bigger OEM car manufacturers, or is your vision to build your own car, to be in competition to those bigger manufacturers?
That's a very interesting question. So we have at the moment no plans to build our own vehicles yet, but we also do not consider ourselves as just a typical supplier. So we are what you would call a tier 0.5 in a way. So we are kind of working together with the OEMs on defining and underpinning these platforms from a variety of technologies. So we have a platform of technologies, which is scalable, meaning motor designs, power electronics, motor control software, and vehicle control software. And all those things are building blocks of a modern vehicle, which is more and more electronic and software defined. And through that, we help to scale these platforms based on OEM requirements and together with the OEMs. So we are more or less working with them for their vehicles, but we keep the technology and the development of these powertrain ecosystem and the powertrain platforms in-house.
Okay. And how far are you in that approach? Have you vehicles already running? Test vehicles? Are they commercially being deployed already? Maybe you can give us a little status on how far you are there.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to announce that two major customers have already started commercial production. So this is Lordstown pickup truck in the US and Lightyear Zero, which is a company based in the Netherlands. And they have both already started production of their vehicles with powertrains that are designed and supplied by us.
Great.
We have had this technology in validation actually for the past 7 years, built over hundreds of vehicles with different OEMs and tested a lot. And we continue to innovate and test for future generations of the platform.
Great. And how many pieces are already out there in the market? Or what is the volume we are talking about with those two first clients out there?
So the first volumes of these clients are small series, which means that it's up to 1,000 vehicles of each. Lordstown obviously has bigger plans. So far, they've committed to building, I think, 500 vehicles, and based on them securing further funding, being as a startup, they will continue to build more. And we are working also with some new startups that have much more ambitious plans in the around 50,000 vehicles per year, up to 100,000 vehicles per year. And with all the OEMs that we work with, obviously, these programs are a lot bigger, but a little bit further into the future.
And are you then actually producing those units, or do you license your technology to these clients and then they do their own production around it?
Both, actually. So our business model is more or less focused on making sure that this technology becomes available to the market. So as long as we are not creating competition for ourselves, we support everything that would be a de-risking strategy for our customers. For example, definitely bigger OEMs, they cannot rely on a single source for something. They need to have some control over their supply chain in order to ensure that they have the commodities they need to build the vehicles at all times. Therefore, in this case, or when, you know, the efforts and timeline and financials are out of our scope, we also license the technology. But at the same time, we always deliver to each of these customers, and we have our own production running. Right now, it's still, let's say, low to mid volume, and we have already initiated activities towards a larger factory that is able to produce more than 100,000 units per year.
So it looks like that you are really about to break through with your technology. So you're just about to scale up. You have done your testings. You have your first key clients on board. How do you finance your growth? Do you do this through normal venture capital, or what are the ways of your growth financing?
And so I think we're one of those startups where we have a longer horizon of return on investment. At least in the past, it was like that. So we're kind of a mix of these two things. We have had Series A investors, which include a large, let's say, Asian tier one who has a minority share, and also InnoEnergy, which is a European public partnership that funds clean tech innovation. So they helped us out a lot. But overall, we are also commercially oriented. So for the past decade or so, we have been self-funded from commercial activities. So we are a sustainable company that actually makes a little bit of profit every year. And we reinvest all our earnings, obviously, into internal development and further development of new markets and new technologies. So we're kind of a very good mix between venture capital, which helps us scale, but also commercial activities, which help us develop, in a way, relevant solutions for the market and get feedback from the market and also grow organically.
So what is eventually your end game? I mean, do you want to stay profitable on your own, license the technology, grow into a more mature company? Or would it be also be a possibility for you to be bought by one of the bigger OEMs who would like to acquire your technology?
At the moment, I think none of those options are actually off the table. But our strategy mainly is to grow the company to a more mature company and eventually exit. But our prime mission still persists, as we are in this to, you know, facilitate the adoption of in-wheel technology and its associated impact on the industry. So we try to make vehicles that are smarter and more rational. And through our technology development, we are trying to contribute that, you know, the world does not need more consumption of energy, but rather to use the amount of space that they have available in vehicles to make more rational vehicles. And this remains our mission. And as long as we can push that mission and continue growing and continuing increasing the impact on this world, that's where we're headed. So definitely we hope to continue growing. However, we do understand that we will need strategic partners for that. And thus an IPO or an exit through an M&A is very likely in the future.
So how would you describe your main bottlenecks right now? What are the main constraints to further or maybe more quicker growth?
Well, this is automotive industry, which means that people are thinking long way ahead. And development, typically pre-development with larger OEMs, takes time. And it's also a lot capital intensive. So like Elon Musk said, you know, production hell, he understands it. So scaling up in this kind of way is definitely one of the challenges. We are actually successfully going through this, but we are a new player in a new market. So the EVs are actually a very early stage market. In-wheel powertrains are even a little bit earlier stage market. And in order to grow quickly here, it's also very capital intensive. So from our side, I think time and capital are definitely one of the things where we can definitely grow faster and more efficiently if those two are in large supply. Technologically, I think we are doing all the right steps. So we've built our own validation labs to keep our cycles, development cycles short. We have developed our own testing standards and product standards where we can really create solutions that fit the automotive and all its requirements for durability and robustness, as well as cost. So I think we're really on a good track here.
And what about skilled labor? Is this a bottleneck as well to get the right and enough people on board? Where are you actually located at? This is probably also important to know.
So our headquarters is based in Slovenia. So this is part of the EU. We border Austria and Italy, in case someone didn't know. It's a very nice country to live in. The standard of living is very high, quality of life as well.
So this is your pitch already to get some people over to you.
already. But objectively, it's not the home of the automotive industry in our segment. So we have a lot of tier two, maybe some tier one, but mostly tier two suppliers focusing more on the production side of things. So castings, machining, some overmolding, plastics, mold injections. We are let's say a lot closer to the customers. And obviously Germany is just a short 3-hour drive, but majority of the skilled labor here is luckily very accessible. So we have a lot of very smart engineers that are really good in electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and physics. And this has helped us grow. But on the business side, I think we also have to, you know, like every company, be close to the customers. So we are also going to, and also already undergoing expansion in relevant markets to be close to the customers.
Luca, this all sounds really great. And before we finish up, what is your view on the future of this electric market? Has the decision been made already that vehicles will be electric and you're good to go? Or what are your takes on the future?
Thank you. It's a very, very interesting question that we think about a lot. So definitely, I think electric powertrains are already decided as the road forward. I think there is going to be a lot of changes on the energy storage side. So battery technologies, propulsion technologies, all of this is definitely evolving and the vehicle is becoming more and more software defined. So a lot more electronics, a lot more code. And this is just going to continue to grow and there's going to be a lot of changes. I think we're probably now at about 10% of the transformation that's happening. But also, you know, autonomous driving and user experience and the way people use mobility modes, all of that is changing and it's going to continue to change and it's going to be more fragmented and depending on geography, depending on, you know, the density of the population and multimodality of public transport, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a high likelihood that when vehicles not only are built in a better way and smarter and more rational, but also the way how they are used right now, 90% of the time they're parked somewhere. With the advent of self-driving technologies and the framework in legislation and everywhere else in the future, hopefully the anticipation is that there's more likely going to be less vehicles overall on the road, but they will be used for much more of the time. And the focus is going to be more on the user experience rather than just on owning a vehicle that you like to drive and that looks good. And from that point of view, our future development is much more focused on that as well. So as much as we are a hardware company, we're also a software company, and we are developing a lot of the technologies that will become more and more relevant as this transformation happens. Everything from, you know, how the powertrain can control and affect the comfort of the occupants or the cargo, and the safety of the occupants and the cargo based on the platform that the vehicle is running on.
And I could imagine the more a vehicle is in use and the smaller it gets, I mean, this is also a question of material use in the future. The smaller the vehicle gets, the more your technology can play out its benefits.
In a way, yes. I mean, our technology is suitable also for the vehicles of current size. However, if you can build a vehicle that still has the same amount of space inside, you have the same comfort for the occupants, for the passengers, but you can actually use less material and have it be smaller and use less energy to move, I think that's a win-win. So definitely, I think we are trying to contribute to this goal. Again, the future is going to be very mission-focused. User experience is leading the design and development of these vehicles. And we just kind of want to help enable this transition so that it's the best user experience, but also the most rational and, you know, win-win for everyone in the value chain.
Great. Win-win. This is a good last word here, at least in this podcast. I wish you a lot of luck. And of course, I have no doubts that you will have a lot of success with your story here. Let's stay in touch and talk to you soon. Bye-bye, Luca.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Have a wonderful day.
Zeit zum Auftauchen. Wir hoffen, dir hat's gefallen. Wenn's so ist, würden wir uns sehr über eine positive Bewertung und dein Abo freuen. Und falls du noch tiefer ins Thema eintauchen möchtest oder Kontakt zu unseren GesprächspartnerInnen suchst, kannst du dich über www.dwr-eco.com ganz einfach bei uns melden. Dieser Podcast wird von DWR Eco produziert, deiner internationalen Cleantech-Beratung für Markt- und Geschäftsstrategien, Politik, PR und Kommunikation.